urged protest sit-ins to condemn what they perceive as Israel's barbarism in Gaza.
Pakistan should move on international fora, United Nations, OIC and other international fora for ceasefire, to save Gaza, to save Palestinians, to stop this genocide, number one. Number two, establish a humanitarian assistance corridor. Number three, start proceeding against Israel in international court of justice and international criminal court, and also on the platform of the OIC for their war crimes, for their crime against humanity in Gaza.
While leaving the comfort of their houses behind, individuals from different faiths and backgrounds gather on the streets, setting up makeshift iftar meals to break their fast during Ramadan. These gatherings were not just about sharing food, they were about sharing solidarity, empathy and hope for the people of Gaza.
This is a message from D Chowk, Islamabad, Pakistan, that we are with you. Our hearts are beating in Gaza, and for the regimes across the globe, our message is that you have been exposed. Your so-called democracy, your so-called freedom of speech, your so-called international humanitarian law are badly exposed.
Images of destruction and suffering from the Israeli war sparked a wave of empathy among people from various walks of life in Pakistan, prompting them to increase their advocacy campaign within their communities for the plight of oppressed people in Gaza.
The gesture of Pakistanis holding protest demonstrations and breaking their fasts on the streets to show solidarity with the oppressed people of Gaza underscores their steadfast commitment to amplifying voices against Israel's ongoing genocide and advocating for a ceasefire. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
Turkish people in 81 provinces took to the polls to choose mayors and provincial council members in local elections. The vote is seen by many as a test of popularity of President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. Erdogan, who started his political life as the mayor of Istanbul, campaigned for the past few weeks to promote his party's candidates. The ruling Justice and Development Party is seeking to win back both the economic hub of the country, Istanbul, and capital Ankara, after receiving a blow from Republican People's Party, CHP, in 2019. For his turn, the CHP is scrambling to maintain both cities and win more. All eyes are now on Istanbul, as the competition between the two main candidates in the city is crucial.
The participation wasn't expected to be the same as the previous election. However, it's not less important than the 2023 one. Erdogan wants to end his presidential term with a victory for his party. And opposition candidate Ekrem İmamoğlu, who wants to participate in the 2028 presidential run, wants this local election to pave the way for his next win.
61 million voters were eligible to vote, with more than 1 million new voters.
I cast my vote for the very first time. I am happy I was able to practice my democratic right. It does not matter who wins, as long as he works for this city and for our district. I want the best for my city, aside from political ideologies.
Mayor of Istanbul Ekrem İmamoğlu and the AKP's candidate Murat Kurum were campaigning for improving services for the city's 60 million residents at a time of widespread economic hardship and double-digit inflation. İmamoğlu has been criticized during his term for heavily focusing on presidential election and his party's leadership rather than solving issues in the city, such as the transportation and the traffic problems and multitude of other issues when heavy snowfall crippled life in Istanbul.
For the past 10 years, I have been living in Istanbul, and I found that the previous mayor, he didn't give the promise he planned to do inside Istanbul. According to the service, the management of the city, we didn't find any change in this situation. For that, I preferred to give the AK Party again, because I think they lost the election last time. It was like a kind of punishment from the people, and I think they learned a good from this lesson.
Opposition party supporters consider this election as another chance to topple the Justice and Development Party and win back power in the country.
I voted for Ekrem İmamoğlu and CHP. I have always supported CHP and will vote for them every time, for this could be our last exit from this nightmare.
Erdogan, who was the mayor of Istanbul in 1994, said during a rally that Istanbul is the jewel, the treasure, and the apple of our country's eye. Analysts say the person that rules Istanbul is able to establish himself a political base, which then translates into power at the national scale. Who wins Istanbul wins Turkey. That's what Erdogan, a mayor of the city in the 1990s, was quoted by a pollster as saying. Against that backdrop, Istanbul today could be choosing Turkey's future president. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
It was the 11th time the British capital had played host to another national demonstration against the US-led Israeli genocide of Palestinians inside Gaza. Coincidentally, this march was taking place on an auspicious day for Palestinians. March 30th is commemorated as Land Day to mark the 1976 Israeli killing of six Palestinians and the wounding of scores more who had gathered to show their affinity for a land that has literally witnessed the constant shedding of Palestinian blood. In an act of solidarity with Palestine, central London showed it would not be letting up on the pressure. Flash forward to this most recent attempt to ethnically cleanse Palestine of its people, and it's clear the UK is being blasted for its complicity in allowing a ceasefire motion to go unacknowledged by Tel Aviv. A comparatively small counter-demo by pro-Israel supporters was peacefully drowned out by pro-Palestinians. The protesters taking part in the demo had a variety of reasons why their presence on the marches mattered.
We just want to bring this conflict into the consciousness of everyone, so everyone understands what's going on here. You know, children being slaughtered, you know, women being slaughtered, the schools and hospitals just completely destroyed. You know, it's just inhumane. It's just a beyond imagination.
We have to stop this. We have to. Don't you? No one can be blind to what's happening. It has to stop. It has to stop. Showing ourselves like this, demonstrating how horrified and outraged we are, and then boycott Israel.
Demonstrators have pledged to keep turning out in the streets to protest against the genocide in Gaza until there's a cessation of violence and justice for Palestinians. Amina Taylor, London.
In Paris and across France, major rallies were held on Palestinian Land Day, which recalls the events of March 30th, 1976, when Israelis killed six unarmed Palestinians and injured 100 others during protests against Israel's confiscation of Palestinian land. The United Nations Security Council finally passed a resolution for a ceasefire in Gaza, but Israel continues to trample on the most basic human rights. Its main arms dealers and political bodyguards, the United States and Germany, have taken no steps to prevent Tel Aviv from murdering even more innocents. The casualty count in Gaza is now well over 100,000, with more than 32,000 Palestinians killed and 75,000 people injured in less than 6 months. Israel continues to do what it once virulently denied ever doing, illegally bombing hospitals, and even arresting scores of doctors and patients in just the last week. Despite spreading famine, Israel has told the United Nations it will not allow any food convoys into northern Gaza, which the UN Secretary General described as a moral outrage. An investigative report just revealed that a French arms company sent nearly a ton of machine gun parts to Israel in October, which were likely used against civilians in Gaza. That contradicts the longtime stance of Paris that the arms it exports to Israel are purely defensive. Christians in Gaza are celebrating their holy Easter weekend amid the invasion, carpet bombing, and famine. Hundreds of historical sites, including many churches, have been destroyed by Israelis in what's been deemed a cultural genocide. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
On the third Friday of Ramadan, tens of thousands of Yemenis filled the streets of Sana'a and several other cities, renewing their unwavering support for Palestinians. Some held banners that read, "We are entering the 10th year and the Palestinian cause remains our priority."
We're entering the 10th year of our resistance against an all-out war on the Yemeni people. We are here today to show our continued support for the Palestinians in Gaza and across the occupied territories. When the countries that possess enormous military capabilities failed to support the Palestinians in Gaza and even conspired with the Israeli regime against them, the war-stricken Yemenis came out to support their oppressed brothers. They left the world in awe with a united front and a soaring popularity in the region.
Protesters chanted slogans vowing to retaliate against the US and the UK airstrikes on the Yemeni cities. They also pledged to escalate their naval operations as long as the Israeli onslaught on Palestinians and the aggression against Yemen continue. Yemenis also slammed the United Nations Security Council for its failure to put an end to the Israeli atrocities in Palestine, despite its recent ceasefire resolution.
We consider the Security Council complicit in the ongoing genocide against Palestinians in Gaza. The United States manipulates the Security Council and the United Nations based on its interests. That is why the U.S. used its veto power three times to prevent a ceasefire in Gaza. But besides that, the Security Council resolutions are ineffective in ending the Israeli atrocities against Palestinians in Gaza.
The problem is not with the Security Council or the United Nations, but with the United States, which has the power to control and manipulate these international organizations. There are many binding decisions that have not been implemented because Washington uses its power against the weak and oppressed people of the world. It is necessary to find an effective mechanism for the Security Council because there are many countries that are yearning to be liberated from the Western hegemony. The events that the world is witnessing in some African countries are a clear proof for this desire for change.
On Thursday, Abdul Malik al-Houthi, the leader of the Ansarullah movement, criticized the US and the UK for exploiting the humanitarian situation in Yemen. He slammed them for threatening to cut the UN-provided aid to Yemenis in order to stop the country's naval operations. Al-Houthi asserted that, according to the US officers, the American Navy has not faced such a humiliation in the international waters since the 19th century.
Neither the military aggression against Yemen nor the cessation of the supply for humanitarian aid has succeeded in halting Yemen's naval operations. Furthermore, officials state that the ongoing Western aggression only serves to motivate the Yemeni army to continue enhancing its capabilities. Abdul Latif al-Washali, Sana'a.
In a fervent display of solidarity with the oppressed people of Gaza, a high-profile event dubbed Palestine Freedom Conference was convened in the capital, Islamabad. Political leaders, scholars, and representatives from various advocacy institutions gathered at the conference to condemn the ongoing Israeli atrocities in Gaza and to advocate for the rights of Palestinians.
The United Nations role is getting more and more important. But we see that United Nations is going on the agenda of Israel and the agenda of America. They are not doing their good efforts to stop this war. Besides stopping the war, they are provoking the war. They are supporting the war. United Nations should take important steps to stop this war.
The event was aimed at amplifying voices against the relentless Israeli attacks on unarmed civilians in Gaza. Scholars and experts also slammed global powers for their role in perpetuating the ongoing genocide and supporting the Israeli regime.
We are not expecting much from the United Nations. More than 3,000 innocent men, women, and children have been killed. But the UN has no courage to stop Israel from doing these inhuman acts in Gaza. Muslim leaders have taken no effective step for a ceasefire in the besieged territory. They should feel shame for their silence on this massacre.
The gathering denounced Israel's military aggression against Gaza and emphasized the importance of upholding the international humanitarian law. The conference underscored the urgent need for international intervention to halt what it described as the bloodshed in Gaza. It also called for practical and immediate steps to alleviate the sufferings of the war-stricken Palestinians.
Participants in the Palestine Freedom Conference pledged to continue their efforts for the people in the Gaza Strip. They vowed to mobilize the support for the implementation of the UN resolution that called for an immediate ceasefire in the territory. Nasser Kazmi, Islamabad.
Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amirabdollahian made a visit to the Turkmen capital of Ashgabat on Wednesday in order to boost bilateral ties between the two countries. Amirabdollahian met with Turkmen President Sardar Gurbanguliyevich Berdimuhamedov. The Iranian top diplomat also met with his Turkmen counterpart Rashid Meredov. During the meeting, both sides expressed satisfaction with the progressing relations between the two countries.
The volume of our trade is boosting significantly, and with the agreements we signed today, we expect a jump in our trade. We will also increase our cooperation in the field of electricity and gas.
Pursuing the memorandum of understandings assigned by the both countries' presidents in 2022 was also one of the main goals of the visit.
One of the main goals of the visit was to pave the way for Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi's visit to Turkmenistan in order to pursue the agreement signed between the two countries.
According to Iranian officials, the relationship between Iran and Turkmenistan is not just a neighborly relationship, but a relationship of brotherhood, and they seek to deepen the ties as regional policy is high on the agenda of the Iranian president's foreign policy. The Iranian foreign minister's visit to Ashgabat is aimed at consolidating bilateral ties. Iran and Turkmenistan enjoy good relations as two neighboring countries, and now Tehran and Ashgabat are planning to further boost their relations in various fields, including trade and economy. Farzan Ashuryun, Ashgabat.
In the holy month of Ramadan, and as part of its commitment to Al-Quds International Day, the Islamic Republic of Iran, via its embassy in Damascus, has distributed several tons of humanitarian aid among Palestinian refugees and resistance factions in Syria. The convoy included essential food kits as a gift from the Iranian nation.
The Islamic Republic of Iran and the Axis of Resistance stand by the oppressed Palestinian people in the face of the Western and American support for the Israeli entity, which has not ceased its crimes against the Palestinian people in Gaza. Today's gathering comes within the framework of supporting the resilient and patient Palestinian people.
This gift is part of a series of annual donations offered by the Islamic Republic of Iran to Palestinian refugees during the month of Ramadan in several Syrian cities, according to Palestinian officials. This large amount of aid delivered by Iran is a message of solidarity with and commitment to the Palestinian cause.
This is a significant step within the framework of Iran's support for the resistance of the Palestinian people. This support has been reflected in all forms and means since the victory of the Islamic Revolution under the leadership of Imam Khomeini, may God rest his soul, and whose legacy continued with the leader Imam Ali Khamenei. Therefore, we as Palestinian people and resistance factions appreciate this gift and everything that the Islamic Republic is providing.
The Palestinian factions expressed their gratitude to the Islamic Republic of Iran for this gift that is presented every year to the Palestinian people.
This aid provided by the Islamic Republic of Iran during the month of Ramadan to the Palestinian people is considered as proof of Iran's great role and the interdependence between the Iranian and Palestinian people. These activities confirm the loyalty of the Palestinian people to the Axis of Resistance, in addition to the fundamental and strategic role of Syria and Iran in the Axis of Resistance.
With this humanitarian aid, Iran demonstrates that true support lies in actions rather than words, and it reflects the enduring place of the Palestinian cause in every Iranian's heart.
This gift is not only a gesture of love from the Iranian leadership and people. More importantly, it underscores their unwavering commitment to help their Palestinian brethren wherever they are. Ibrahim Wahdi, Damascus.
Imam Ali, peace be upon him, said, "The Lord Most High has chosen for us certain followers, Shiites, who assist us. If we are joyful, they are joyful. And if we are sorrowful and sad, they are sorrowful and sad."
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
Majh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
In this episode, we want to present to you an extract from the speech of the Supreme Leader of Iran, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, about Imam Ali alayhi salam. The commander of the faithful words and addresses, full of enthusiasm and full of wisdom, have provided instructive lessons for all humans to live by to this day. And these are all signs of his strengths. His robust physique, intellect, determination, management, and style of rhetoric were all indications of a strong and powerful individual. At the same time, this strong man was wrong. Signs of oppression against him could be witnessed in the behavior of his enemies and the envious. They could be witnessed in the unfair accusations that were leveled against him by the agents of his enemies during his lifetime and in the materialistic behavior of some of his companions. A number of his companions and comrades broke away from him because they pursued their materialistic desires. These are hints of oppression against that great personality. The burdens that were exerted on him from various sides were so vast that this patient, ocean-like heart of a man was so tolerant that he is said to have complained into a well. He would open up into a well. These instances are all indications of the persecution faced by the commander of the faithful.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
After his demise and martyrdom, his enemies, who had seized the government, would insult him for many years at their podiums. They would insult him throughout that vast country. They would speak harshly of the commander of the faithful, who was the embodiment of piety, justice, and fair-mindedness. Coincidentally, when we take a general look at those events, we see in that prolonged battle, the commander of the faithful was the final victor. Today, notice where the commander of the faithful's name and personality stands in this vast human panorama and history. He stands at the peak, and there is no trace of his enemies. His Nahjul Balagha, which was compiled by Sayyid al-Razi, one of the Shi'ite scholars, is an instructive lesson for heightened individuals. His tradition is the most important and prominent tradition after that of the Holy Prophet of Islam. His form of justice and his great personality were outstanding features in this day and age. His cause defeated that of his enemies. He was the final victor.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Sajjad, peace be upon him, has said, "Whenever I remember the martyrdom of the children of Fatima, peace be upon her, my eyes filled with tears."
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
And welcome. The Iranian consulate in Damascus came under a missile attack and it was completely razed to the ground. So far, what we know is that at least five people, three of them Iranians, have been killed in this attack. And according to the Iranian foreign minister and Iranian sources, as well as the Iranian ambassador in Damascus, Israel should be held responsible for this attack, which is, of course, a very big red line crossed by the Israeli regime. according to both of these officials. And this will be the topic of tonight's show. I'm Gisumi Shah Ahmadi, and you're watching The Spotlight. We will be discussing this attack with our guests, Jamal Wakim, professor of international relations from the Lebanese University, joining us live from Beirut. And also Saeb Shaf, author and West Asia expert, who is joining us live from Belfast. Thank you very much to both of you gentlemen for joining us. Now, this was the big news of the day, making the headlines and, of course, attracting a lot of attention. And, of course, it should. It definitely deserves that much attention because although we've had Israel undermining Syria's sovereignty time and again, attacking different targets in Syria's soil, this time it crossed a very big red line by attacking the consulate of Iran right next to its embassy in Damascus, razing the whole building to the ground. So, Mr. Jamal Wakim, in your opinion, why did Israel choose to attack the Iranian consulate at this point in time?
Well, first, we need to understand the nature of the objective targeted by Israel, which is the Iranian consulate, considered as Iranian territory. We know that embassies and consulates all over the world are considered as territories of the country that they represent. So this is a big red line that Israel is crossing. In addition, it's targeting, of course, Iranian diplomats other than the Iranian military commanders, which is another factor that needs to be taken in consideration. So why at this time Israel is going into such an escalation? I believe that it's trying to achieve something at a time when it's dragging on, the war is dragging on, and it's not being able to achieve tangible results against the armed resistance in Gaza, nor against the armed resistance in Lebanon. And it might be that the Israelis want to turn the attention of the whole world, especially the West, away from Gaza onto a side conflict that it's trying to drag Iran to in order to justify its continuous war against Gaza on one hand, and in order to silence the criticism, some of the criticism against it in the West, especially among some governments which are voicing their concern, Western governments, which started to voice their concerns about the human toll in Gaza on one hand, and who are considering withdrawing their support to Israel in this aggression on the other hand.
Okay, so Mr. Shaf, our guest from Beirut believes that Israel is trying to deviate attention at this point in time from the ongoing genocidal war on Gaza. Now, before we get into what's going on in Gaza and what is exactly the position of Israel right now in Gaza and whether or not it has been able to achieve any of its military objectives there, let's look at some other issues that could be taken into consideration, and one of them is the fact that Israeli media have been stating that they intended to attack a car that was parked in front of the consulate and not the consulate itself. So, first of all, aside from the fact that this could not be considered a legitimate excuse because the consulate building has been completely razed to the ground, what does that mean? Is Israel afraid of any kind of escalation? Because as our guest in Beirut just mentioned, this is a very serious provocation.
Yes, it is a very serious provocation. But from what I witnessed lately, the United States of America or the Zionist Institute, they don't give a damn about what the public opinions internationally is concerned or not. And the only thing, even his own public opinion, Netanyahu, we see the administrators for the release of their own hostages or that, they don't give a damn. They want to continue war. Netanyahu, for him, the war is a lifesaver. He can stay in power and he can be immune. So in a way, I agree with Jamal about the failures in Gaza. They cannot even justify anything to their own public opinion or to the United States of America or the Western supporters. They want to move forward, especially after last night when the Iraqi resistance managed to attack in Eilat a Navy base and devastated it. Actually, we've seen the smoke, we've seen the panic and the ambulances, all of that, that direct hit. And the same thing, we see how the Palestinian resistance are still in control, and the Zionists and the Americans and the Western forces who's taking part in there, because we know there is a French on the ground with dual citizenship, there is American expertise, there is what they call it, surveillance, British drones and fighter jets in the region. And all of that, we see the Palestinian is still showing a formidable resistance. And in Yemen, as well, the resistance camp in Yemen, it's extended its influence and made the American armada from air carriers, fighter jets, carriers, and ships looks like absolute in the region, and it's extended the influence of the targets we said will reach from the Arabian Sea, the Red Sea, the Indian Ocean, even to Africa. So after any Zionist ships or going toward the Zionist ship, so they've seen all of that, and they still know. Before, a couple of months ago, they were talking about devastating Syria, to isolate Syria totally from the supply chain, as they call it, of the resistance. And that's why we've seen how they sneak with their fighter jets from the TANF, which is supported and protected that region by American radars and American surveillance system, to go and hit in Aleppo. And the same thing, we see the resistance as well is increasing its own activities to target and keep the momentum high to target the Zionist entity. If you can see, there is the Iraqis hit as well in Haifa and in Eilat, and the Yemenis as well, and the Lebanese resistance escalating with using new weapons and new techniques. All of that. But the American hegemony in that region in question. And this is why we see there is consensus in the West in supporting the Zionist entity, even not even complicit in genocide with it, but even party to the genocidal war. So targeting an Iranian property and an Iranian sovereign piece of land like the embassy and the consulate in there, it's escalating that, because they believe themselves without the Iranian technology and transfer the know-how to the resistance in Gaza or in Yemen or in Lebanon or in Iraq, they won't be able to direct such blows. So there is escalation here, and the Israelis already raised the alarm to all of their embassies around the world to be on the guard.
Okay, so Mr. Joachim, before we delve into the issues that were just raised by Mr. Schaaf, has Israel achieved any of its military objectives, the ones that it stated before it started the war on Gaza?
So far, Israel didn't achieve any of its declared objectives. It couldn't destroy the resistance there. It couldn't free the prisoners of war. And it couldn't expel the Palestinian people out of Gaza Strip onto Sinai as it intended. The only thing that Israel was able to achieve there was to target civilians, destroy Gaza, the whole infrastructure, target civilians and kill more than 35,000 civilians so far. Most of them are children and women. And of course, it's trying to terrorize the civilian population as a mean to render what was considered as a victory achieved by the resistance into a very costly victory. That's what the Israelis are trying to do. And of course, this is part of their tradition, part of their culture, to commit genocide against the Arabs. And this was this is not the first time that they massacre civilian people. We have hundreds of evidence throughout the Arab-Israeli struggle. As far as it concerns, for example, the military strikes against Lebanon and Syria, they have been able to target some high-ranking officials, and this is due to the bitterness they feel in their conflict against the resistance, both in Gaza and in southern Lebanon, and of course against the Houthis and the resistance in Iraq, because they think that it's Iran that is supporting all these resistance factions in a common cause against the Israeli occupation and colonization of Palestine. So this is what's going on, and this is how we could understand Israeli actions.
So Mr. Shath, as our guest from Beirut just clearly stated, Israel has not been able to achieve any of its military objectives, the one that it had stated at the beginning of this war. And on the other hand, like our guest said, we have over 35,000 Palestinians killed, more than 75,000 injured in these attacks that is now being called a genocidal war. Israel has a court case in the ICJ against it. The investigations are ongoing. It even has a provisional ruling that has been issued. We are seeing demonstrations in countries that were traditionally the allies of Israel. Now we're seeing people coming out chanting slogans against the Israeli regime. Where does this leave the Zionist entity?
The Zionist entity, let's say it historically, put it in perspective, from the time when the French Revolution came with the slogan of Jewish emancipation, it was an idea to cleanse all the Jews from Europe and put them in Palestine. And this is when the French led their campaign and occupied Egypt and tried to occupy Palestine in 1799. Bonaparte failed in creating the Zionist entity, which is today is there, and to make it as a tool for his own domination of the world. The English then achieved that goal and that. So the Zionist entity all along, it was a colonial project. It doesn't matter the lies these the Zionist secular or religious factions of it, they can produce. And we noticed the Zionist factions, the right wing was allied to Nazi Germany and organized with Hitler their own evacuation of Jews before the Holocaust to Palestine. And the left of the Zionist, like Haganah and all of that factions of terrorist groups, were allied to the British. So they were betting in the two horses in the game. If the German wins, the Nazis, they are with them winning. And if the Nazis of America and the British and the Soviet Union won, they are with them as well. So this is what we see. It's always they put themselves as to be the prize of the winner in there, and to function as its own military base there. And so in the, this is what they are. So Israel doesn't give a damn. It's shielded by the international law, and they think they are above the law because they
are. So, Mr. Shah, I'm sorry to cut you off right there because we have a limited amount of time, but we can conclude by what you and our guest from Beirut just said, that Israel is at its weakest point ever in history because it has a UN resolution against it. It's a staunch ally. The U.S. abstained from voting this time. It has been isolated politically from a diplomatic point of view. It has definitely lost the propaganda war. And whenever Israel is at its weak point, it usually carries out these attacks. It's not the first time this is happening to Iran. We've had Razi Mousavi, General Brigadier General Razi Mousavi, another IRGC commander that was targeted just 4 months ago. So, Mr. Wakim, what do you think this attack means, considering all the issues that were just raised?
Well, this attack is a big infringement on Iran's sovereignty, and of course Israel is trying to pull Iran into a direct conflict. Well, if I put myself in the shoes of the Iranian officials, they are in a very dire situation, because if they retaliate, if they react, they will be they might be playing the game of Israel, and if they don't, they would be let's say embarrassed internationally by Israel. So it's a very delicate equation here. Would Iran retaliate right now or leave it to another opportunity? Especially that the conflict is open and it will drag on in the future. We shall wait and see. But I believe that Iran has been hit hard, and maybe it needs to retaliate, to react to such an aggression.
Okay, so Mr. Shaf, I see that you were shaking your head at some point in disagreement with our guest from Beirut. And looking at Iran's record, well, it's not the first time that Iran has been put on the spot by Israel where it was provoked to carry out some kind of attack or create some kind of escalation in the region. And when we look back in history, every time Iran has responded to these attacks, but in a very strategic manner and with definitely consideration, great consideration for the long-term consequences of whatever it does. So, Mr. Shaf, although we had the Iranian ambassador clearly stating that Iran will be giving a decisive response to this attack, what could that decisive response entail, considering Iran's history?
You see, this is a significant escalation in its own. And by targeting a sovereign, as I said, territory of Iran, which is the embassy, Donald Trump targeted the martyr First Lieutenant Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis in Iraq when he was brokering peace at the time himself and was officially invited to the country, the Iranian government didn't wait, and they devastated Ain al-Assad, the biggest American military base around the world, which is in Iraq. They didn't wait. It means a lot to the country to see its act and straight away take. It's not about tit and tat kind of activity. It's here. It's the dignity of the nation, the dignity of the people. It's the martyrs' need to be revenged before, as the Arab would say, before their blood dry on the ground. So that is kind of aggression. It need to be responded to. When, how, that is up to the Iranian people and the Syrian government as well, since this has happened on Syria's ground. Syria is, as well, I see, is partly responsible. We know all the Syrian air defense was destroyed from the terror and takfiri war waged by the Western and the Zionist countries in Syria when they dismantled the supposed to be revolutionary the radars and the anti-air missiles and that, and kept Syria as open. And this is the result of their operation, which is organized by the Zionists and the Americans at the time, Syria cannot defend itself, not even 10%, I don't want to say more, and from after T-35 and sophisticated American weaponry. So the United States of America, since the day it's put sanctions against Iran, from the day of the Islamic Revolution in 1979 till today, it's put Iran as the bullseye, as they say, and its target. And the Iranian people and the Iranian government and leadership understand that very well. Iran today is 100 times stronger than before, and Iran today is scared them in the region, because Iran leading a resistance camp is on the win and putting their projects of hegemony and the Zionist project on the reverse. So the resistance or Iran won't be afraid of revenging the martyrdom of its own people.
Okay, so Mr. Wakim, we don't have much time left, but why do you think, and this is a recent sentence by Mr. Shouth, which totally echoed the comments made by the Iranian ambassador to Damascus, that Iran is not afraid of Israeli atrocities. Where do you think this courage comes from, and what exactly does that mean?
Well, of course, Iran has been able to build its power over the four decades, or even five decades now. And it has sophisticated weapons. It was able to build its economy despite the sanctions and despite the boycott imposed on it by the West. And a lot of powers, not only in the region but worldwide, are relying on Iranian weapons and technology now. But that's why the Iranians are so confident in their stance, and this has been experienced before, especially in confrontation with the United States. But I believe that Iran has the capability to react and to retaliate. However, it's all about the timing. What would be the best time that Iran would choose to retaliate? This is the question.
Well, thank you very much. I'm afraid that's all the time that we have. Jamal Wakim, Professor of International Relations from the Lebanese University, joining us live from Beirut, and also Saeb Shouth, author and West Asia expert, joining us from Belfast. Thank you very much to both of you gentlemen for sharing your thoughts and views with us on this edition of Spotlight.